produces the apparatus which reads and writes the disks.
Yes, Your Honor.
And they sell that component to other manufacturers who in turn sell it to consumers, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And in that context, who is Quanta Storage inducing to infringe? The manufacturers or the ultimate consumers?
Both, Your Honor. There is...
What's the evidence that they're inducing infringement by the ultimate consumers?
The evidence that they're inducing infringement by the ultimate consumers is that they have designed and programmed the drive so that the drive, when used as intended, automatically and predictably results in infringement of the
manufacturers. In order to have inducement, you've got to have some sort of communication to the consumers. Producing the product is not enough.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I believe in this circumstance, producing the product and distributing it is enough. And the Supreme Court, in its Grokster case at footnote 13, I believe specifically said that with appropriate evidence of intent, which of course we have by the communications with the OEM manufacturers, that the distribution of a product designed to specifically infringe can, in fact, be sufficient for inducement. I think that this...
But not if it has other functions. If one function is infringing and the other function is not, what kind of inducement do you have at that point?
Well, I think it is clear under the circumstances that the drives are set up and marketed in a way that that users are encouraged to use the recording functions of the drive, because if users were interested in only carrying out the reading functions, which is to say the non-infringing functions of the drive, they could buy a Quanta drive that has only the non-infringing reading functions.
But even the writing functions don't necessarily infringe. For example, the buffer on the run would only infringe if there was a circumstance that presented buffer underrun.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor, although I think buffer underrun is actually a circumstance where the evidence is strongest that there were too routinely and almost always is infringement. And in fact, the district court, in its opinion, recognized expressly that buffer underrun events, and this is in page 19 of the joint appendix, page 19 of the court's opinion, buffer underrun events are ordinary and expected occurrence in an optical disk drive, particularly when a drive is attached to a host computer on which multiple applications are running simultaneously.
But it doesn't necessarily.
There could be circumstances in which it doesn't happen, but it is ordinary and expected that it should happen. And certainly a jury could conclude that it does happen routinely.
And also, some of the patents only relate to activities for recording on rewritable media.
That's correct. Two of the patents are applied both to recordable and rewritable media. And two of the patents, which is to say the background form,
5 and 109.
Yes, are for rewritable disks only.
So, for those consumers that ultimately use recordable media, then that doesn't apply. That method would not be conformed.
It would be true that if there were users who chose to use only recordable media and not rewritable media, they would not have occasion to use those two patents, the 955 and 109.
So
but there's no evidence that there are such.
How do we know on this record that wasn't the case in most situations, some situations?
Well,
we're left to speculate as to whether that actually is accomplished or not.
Well, I don't believe that one's left to speculate. I think that the evidence in the record is the best evidence obtainable of how the drives function and how they're expected to function. I don't think, for example, if one contrasts this with the recent ACCO decision from this court, in which the court said, well, you should have gone out and taken surveys or gotten better direct evidence of infringement. The court stressed that it would have been relatively easy to find out whether there was infringement there. And I think that the court also emphasized that in that case, unlike here, there was no evidence of intent to cause infringement. All of the circumstantial evidence was pointing against infringement, and under those circumstances, the court felt that it would be too speculative to suppose that someone out there somewhere might be infringing. Here, we have a situation where there is evidence of intent to cause infringement. They know about the features, advertise them as better than others. They designed the drive.
Pardon, is the problem. They didn't advertise them to the ultimate consumers, right?
Right, but that really doesn't matter.
You know, well, it does, I think. If you look at footnote 13, as you referred to in Roxford, it talks about encouraging. I'm not sure that there's any authority to the idea that the mere sale of a product is inducement without inducement to infringe a process without some separate encouragement to the purchaser to use that product to infringe. That contributory infringement is a different question. We'll get to that.
Right.
We're talking about inducement here.
Right. But in the context of inducement, what the Supreme Court said in Grokster is that there has to be evidence of intent to cause infringement. And here we certainly have evidence of intent to cause infringement because
yeah,
the drives
right. Encouragement.
No, but it also says that the Supreme Court also said that it doesn't matter whether the encouragement was received, because the point of the encouragement is to show the state of mind of the
well,
of the encourager.
Let's suppose we say that encouragement is necessary. There has to be some encouragement to find inducement of infringement by the ultimate consumers. There has to be some encouragement. There's no evidence in this record of encouragement, right?
Well, there is evidence of encouragement in two senses, for end users now. Obviously, I think that the evidence is remarkably strong with regard to the original equipment manufacturer customers, and that alone is reason that it was error to grant summary judgment. With regard to the end user infringers, the encouragement comes in the form of a more limited promotion in that the drives are advertised to be, for example, 24x drives or 48x speed drives. And those features, the 24x speed, can only be achieved by using, for example, the Zone CLD.
But not advertised by Quanta Storage, the ultimate consumer.
Sure, Your Honor. No, on the Quanta Storage website, and we have copies of the pages in the joint appendix, it says this is a drive, it's 24x drive or 48x drive.
Well, I don't know that's directed to the ultimate consumer.
Well, it's telling the whole world, the people who would be buying drives.
Do you think that there's evidence that consumers read the website?
Well, there's evidence that when consumers can't get the drives to write as advertised, they email to Quanta Storage and say, my drive isn't working.
There's no evidence that they read the website and understood that they were being encouraged to use it for an infringing, what the fact is infringing use, right?
Your Honor, I think that people, what the record shows is that people who buy the drives are trying to buy drives that write at particular speeds, and the evidence is that they can't write at particular speeds without using the infringing features, and the evidence is also that when they are unable to write at the speeds that they desire, they complain about it.
Well, I want to ask another question about inducement relating to the sales by Quanta Storage to the manufacturers. My understanding is that the manufacturers are alleged to infringe because they test the product received from Quanta Storage, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. What evidence is there that Quanta Storage knew that the testing that would be infringing is going on?
Quanta Storage helps them to carry out the tests, Your Honor. They have a dedicated sales force for each of the major computer manufacturers whose job it is to ensure that the tests are carried out in such a way to show that the drives perform as the specifications demand. And so they have full-time people for Hewlett-Packard, for Dell, for Gateway, whose job it is to be sure that the drives will be qualified for use in those computer companies' devices. So they knew about it. They helped develop the test protocols. There's no doubt about the fact that they know what's going on there. And the question is, why are Dell and Gateway doing these tests? It's not because Dell has an awful lot of DVDs that it would like to record that the tests are being carried out. Rather, the tests are being carried out to ensure that when end users turn on the computers and record disks using the drive, which is what the purpose of the drive is, that they will do so in the fast, reliable, convenient way that's made possible by the patented methods here.
Okay, so let's turn to contributory infringement.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you agree that this is a question of first impression here as to whether the inclusion of this write feature in here can be considered separately from the device as a whole?
I don't believe that this court has squarely addressed that question. That's right.
And your view is that because there is a portion of the hardware here that is used for write only, that there's not a substantial non-infringing use for that portion of the device?
That's correct.
And what does the evidence show that, what does the evidence show that there is a separate portion of the hardware devoted to write only?
Well, the evidence shows that you can buy a read-only drive. So you can have all of the hardware for reading, which is sold separately by Quanta. And for more money, you can pay to get a drive that reads and writes. And those writing the software modules and the associated circuitry, for which you pay extra.
Did anybody describe the circuitry and the hardware that's necessary for the write function?
It's undisputed, Your Honor, that there are software modules in the drive that are designed for writing that have no other non-infringing use.
Hardware?
I think the reports talk about software modules and associated circuitry. I do not recall the level of detail at which the hardware was analyzed, but certainly the software modules are distinct and have no separate use.
But the methods that are recited in the claims of these patents are performed by the use not only of the software modules and whatever associated hardware there might be, but by things like the motors and the lasers and things that are shared with the read function of the optical drive. In other words, the optical drive that we're talking about that performs both the read capability and the write capability may have separate functionality and may have separate components, but there are also a lot of shared components. It's not easily separated. This is not a question of having in one shell a separate read unit and a separate write.
Well, I think that the way to approach that issue, Your Honor, is by reference to the text of the statute, which says that liability for contributory infringement attaches whenever a person sells a material or apparatus for use in practicing a patented process, constituting a material part of the invention, knowing the same to be especially made or adapted for use in an infringement of such patent, and not a staple article of commerce suitable for substantial non-infringing use. When one looks at that and says, well, what is it that has to be especially made or especially adapted for use in infringement? It is a material or apparatus that constitutes a material part of the invention. I don't think there's any doubt that the software modules at issue here constitute a material part of the invention and are therefore, because we know that they can be separated, are suitable for analysis under the statute. Now, it may also be the case that you have a product where there are, suppose one sold sub-assemblies. It might be that you would sell the right chip with other associated hardware that would be put into a drive. That might also be a contributory infringement. I don't think the analysis has to happen at just one level of the machine.
Well, what's your theory? What's your theory that any inclusion of any feature in a device which can only be used to perform the patented method makes the device infringing?
I think that by its terms, if you have a separately identifiable component, which is not always the case in some of the cases, for example, Sony was one where there was no real way of separating the functions. If you have a separable component that constitutes a material part of the invention and has no substantial non-infringing use, I think 271C applies. Yes, Your Honor.
But if you're not selling just the component, you're selling the whole drive.
Well, I think it's well established that if one sells a car with an infringing carburetor, one is selling the carburetor even if the contract for sale talks about the car. Certainly, in this court, in the ITC context, the court is constantly faced with circumstances in which a computer chip, for example, will be accused to be infringed, to infringe a patent, and there will be exclusion orders that apply to cell phones or computers or cable set-top boxes or any number of things, of which the accused component is a part. So I think it's pretty clear that one can sell or import a component of the device when one imports the device.
Is there any evidence in the record establishing the record?
Well, there is evidence in the record establishing a direct infringement by the end user, by the original equipment manufacturer, computer makers, and by defendant knew, and some of the tests showing that all of the features were used are summarized in, for example, footnote 4 of our reply brief, which has a number of record citations.
With respect to the direct infringement, the final consumer was not established to be directly infringing.
But, Your Honor, and this comes back to the point I was beginning to make in response to Judge Lynn's question earlier, there is no good way to do to establish direct infringement here, and that is a key point of distinction between this case and, for example, ACCO. And that's for two reasons. Number one, even if you could find the end users who have the Quanta drives, they would not be able to tell you whether they're doing the infringing methods because the methods are invisible for the most part to all except the most technically sophisticated users. Second of all, you can't even find the end users that have these particular drives. What was established is that first of all, the drives are branded products. So if you go to your notebook computer, rip the drive out and look at it, it will not say Quanta on it. It will say Philips or Sony or OptiArc. And it will probably have the name of the computer maker on it too. And so even by looking, even if you ask people, do you have a Quanta drive, they wouldn't be able to tell. So the only place to go to find out how many of these drives there are and where they ended up is with the original equipment manufacturer people who we spoke to, and even they don't know which drives went into which computers. Because
you need to establish direct infringement before you can establish indirect.
Your Honor, I believe that we can, and we have the best evidence that's available to establish direct infringement because of the way that the drives operate by default. And I think I realize that in ACCO and in Dynacor, the court stated a principle which, although appropriate in those cases, is not a binding rule of decision for all inducement cases. And if applied too broadly, would run afoul of Grokster and would also lead to illogical results. I think the key features about Dynacor and about ACCO were that you had a situation where there was no evidence that anyone had actually directly infringed the patent. There was no evidence of inducement or intent to cause infringement. In fact, just the opposite. All of the instructions in those cases were to use a non-infringing method. And finally, all of the circumstantial evidence pointed against there being any direct infringement. And in those circumstances, the court was forced to say, look, if you want to avoid summary judgment, you've either got to show us that somebody really did this, or else you've got to show us that there's no way to avoid doing it. But without anything there to go on, we're stuck. We have to grant summary judgment against you. Here, by contrast, we don't have a good way of getting evidence of direct infringement, unlike in ACCO. And it would be unreasonable to require direct proof that can't be gotten. Second of all, there's strong circumstantial evidence of direct infringement, not only by the people testing, but there's direct evidence of that, but by the end users because of the way the drive is designed to operate automatically. And finally, there's evidence of encouragement.
You keep referring to the way the drive is designed to operate automatically, but as we discussed with respect to several of the patents and several of the features, there are also ways in which the optical drive can operate without it.
Well, but the question, Your Honor, is why would in principle, one could disable the features of the drive. One could, a technically sophisticated user could.
I'm not talking about disabling anything. I'm talking about, for example, using them on not rewritable media, but recordable media only.
Well, but even in those circumstances, you would have infringement of two of the patents in suit.
Well, that's right, but two of the patents you would not. So, and then you've got situations where there may not be the buffer underrun, and you may not have other situations, so it's not automatic.
Well, if automatic means that if I think it would be an odd rule if it were necessary to show in order to survive a liability question on summary judgment. I mean, maybe there could be arguments made. It's an interesting question whether arguments could be made about the extent of damages as a result of there possibly being some circumstances in which this was not infringed. But in order to avoid summary judgment of liability, given the high likelihood that this happens and the evidence that people complain when it doesn't happen, given the direct infringement...
Why didn't you had discovery, right, in this case, before the summary judgment motion, right?
There was discovery, of course.
Yeah, so... And you had the ability to survey consumers or even to subpoena consumers.
Well, but I think the point...
How come that you didn't get any evidence of direct evidence direct infringement. Why are you in a position of having to rely on these inferences?
Well, that was the point that I was trying to make in response to Judge Lynn's question earlier, is that there is no reliable way to identify who has these drives, and even if you could find them, they couldn't tell by looking at the drives that they had a Quanta drive. And even if they could tell that they had a Quanta drive, they wouldn't know, except in the rarest of circumstances, whether the drive was carrying out the infringement.
Just because it's difficult doesn't mean that you're excused from proof.
Well, Your Honor, again, I think in circumstances where there is strong circumstantial evidence that it happens, where there is evidence that it was intended to happen, and that the drive was designed specifically to facilitate this behavior, it seems odd to require that if anything less than a 100% infringement results from the use of the product, that there can't be liability for inducement. I think in Grokster, again, it was assumed that there was some non-copyrighted works that were being copied, and yet the Supreme Court was willing to say that there was enough evidence there, was enough substantial infringement to get past liability. Well, we have extensive evidence here of direct infringement in the form of people complaining when they couldn't write in the way that was promised.
But your infringement case is not limited to only those people, only those tests that your allegation is with respect to direct infringement across the board based on all sales of the optical drives, correct?
Yes, but even Quanta's own damages expert, Dr. Reed, did his calculation based on all of the infringing sales. He quibbled about how many drives actually made it to the United States, but he didn't try to reduce the amount of damages based on the thought that some people might not be carrying out the infringing method. So I think the assumption of Quanta's own case is that the drives are used in an infringing manner.
Okay, then we've reached the quibbling point.
I appreciate that.
May it please the court. There is no dispute here that if a drive is reading, it's not infringing. And under the contributory infringement statute, if a device, an apparatus, has a substantial non-infringing use, there's no contributory infringement. The statute focuses on the thing that was sold, having a
Why is that true? I mean, take the hypothetical. We're dealing with a method, and let's make it simple so I can understand. We're dealing with a method of removing a nail from the bolt, and there's a hammer that has a specially adapted claw which can only perform the patented method of removing the nail. But it also has a head for pounding nails into the bolt. Are you saying that the sale of that hammer, which has head which can be used in a non-infringing way, and a claw that can't be, is not covered?
I would say, Your Honor, in that case, you look at whether the allegedly infringing use is a substantial non-infringing use. And I think here there's no dispute that reading is a substantial non-infringing use.
Assuming my hypothetical that half the time the hammer is used to pound the nails into the board, and the other half the time it's used to extract. And you're saying that because somebody could use it to pound nails into the board means that it's not contributory infringement.
I'm saying that you look at the substantiality of the non-infringing use, and I'm suggesting that pounding the nail into the board is not a substantial non-infringing use of that hammer in that situation.
Why not?
Under your hypothetical, if the patent is directed to removing nails, then I don't think that pounding a nail into the board would be a substantial non-infringing use. Here, the thing that was... I think that it's a non-substantial use of that hammer in that instance, Your Honor. I'm suggesting here that...
You've got a problem here, I think, because in that hypothetical, I would say, think that most people, as apparently you do too, would say that the sale of that hammer is a contributory infringement of the method for removing the nails. But I'm trying to distinguish between that in this situation and other situations. Obviously, a very difficult and important problem. And I'm asking, where would you draw the line?
Well, Your Honor, if you look at the Hodash case, which was not cited in the briefs, it's at 833 F2
1575. I'm not sure that it was dealing with D rather than C. I'm not sure exactly what that case means.
Okay. Well, let's draw the line in this case. I don't think that this drive is as easily divisible as the plaintiff is suggesting. Even the RICO's own expert, Dr. Schlesinger, stated that each drive has a single laser used for both reading and writing. That's at A2072. It's clear that each disk has one pickup head, one motor to spin the disk. That pickup head is used for both reading and writing. So
there's a dual function then taken out of contributory function? Or is it because you can use it both ways and you're not quite sure which way to use it?
Well, I think it's
used in a method that would be prescribed by the patent.
I think it shows, Your Honor, that there is a substantial non-infringing use of the drive and that you can't divide reading from writing as the plaintiff has suggested.
If I use it 50% of the time to read, 50% of the time to write, which would be substantial?
Well, Your Honor, there's no evidence of end users and how often or how frequently they use the drugs.
If I use it 50% of the time to read each one.
Well, I would think that there would be 100% of the time a substantial amount of infringing use, because in this case, you can't divide reading from writing. So there is a substantial non-infringing use for the thing sold. And the statute focuses on the thing being sold, not a subcomponent of what's being sold, but actually what was sold. You look at what was sold. Is there a substantial non-infringing use for the thing being sold?
Yeah, but the statute uses the word component, doesn't it?
A component of an apparatus, but the component is the thing being sold. Here, the drive itself is the component, the thing being sold.
I mean, this is very troubling, because you're saying any time, no matter how elaborate the device is in being designed to perform the infringing method, that as long as it has some other use, even though that use doesn't require all the features of the device, that it becomes non-infringing.
I'm not saying in every instance. I'm saying you look at...
Where's the line? That's the problem. Where's the line? How do we draw the line?
Well, I can draw the line in this case. And I think maybe you take that up on a case-by-case basis. In this case, there is clearly a substantial amount of infringing use for the thing sold. And you cannot divide the reading from the writing function.
But is that true? I thought that there was software modules and perhaps hardware also, which was only to be used for the write function.
That software may be used only for the write function, but that is only one of the steps of the claim. There are other steps of the claim for which you have to spin the disk. There are other steps.
Isn't that a component that meets the terms of the statute?
But we're not selling that component. We're selling an apparatus.
Of which that is a part.
It is a part of the apparatus, yes.
So you're selling a component, albeit with other things. And that component, which provides the right capability, that component has no substantial non-infringing use, does it?
I would say that there is software that may be used to do some of the four features, but that make up the patents. But it's not clear that those four features are actually infringing when used. There are lots of ways to record and therefore use some of that code that wouldn't be infringing. You could use the drive at a low speed. You wouldn't use a zone CLV. You could record without interrupting, without doing other things. You wouldn't use buffer underrun. So there are lots of things you can do with that code that would be non-infringing.
So
So no, I don't think by just selling that code, you are selling something that does not have a substantial non-infringing use. It certainly
you're
does.
Saying the software modules that are in the devices that you're selling are not specially adapted to perform in combination ultimately the functions set forth in these claims and these patents?
That's correct. As the court noted, not all recording, they're designed to record. That module, that software module is designed to record. It's not necessarily designed to record using those particular functions. I don't think you can divide the software
up. What is it in your drive that provides that capability? You do sell drives that provide the capabilities that are set forth in these claims, do you not?
Well, I would quibble with that, saying, no, we don't, because we have a non-infringement position. But we do provide drives that perform the four features that RICO alleges claim infringing patents.
And what is it that gives you the capability to perform those functions? It's the software module.
Well, it's the entire apparatus that we sell. It's the pickup head, it's the motor, it is some software. It's a number of different components of the entire apparatus.
Of which there are software modules and some associated hardware that are a part of.
Yes, but that software module that is a part of it, some of it may deal with recording, but not all recording is an infringement. You can record even at high speeds for some of the drives and not implicate the ZCLV mode, which RICO alleges infringes.
So you're saying even the software modules, the components that provide the right capability and have additional functionality that you would argue is a substantial non-infringing functionality?
Certainly the entire software component has other functionality. That's right. I mean, where do you draw the line about dividing? I mean, do we have to go to lines of code? That's what I'm trying to suggest, is that you should look at the thing being sold and does it have a substantial non-infringing use. The idea here is not to rewrite the law of contributory infringement. You still don't answer the question of inducement. If the product has a substantial non-infringing use.
Those are separate issues.
But they're related. They both relate to indirect infringement. The statute was written.
Are there affidavits by experts telling us what portions of the hardware and software are devoted to the right only function?
Are we going to have that?
No, I'm not. Do you have it now? Is it part of the summary judgment record?
There is some testimony in the record about what part of some piece of software is dedicated to a certain function, yes. But if you look at the entirety of the software, there's no dispute that that software is used for both reading and writing. And that's why I'm suggesting the answer to this question is not to rewrite the law of contributory infringement, where you focus on the thing being sold. And under the statute, if the thing being sold has a substantial non-infringing use, there's no contributory infringement. That doesn't answer.
No matter how many features it has, no matter how much hardware it has, no matter how much software it has, which can only be used to infringe.
I'm not saying that. I would have to look at each item being sold on a case-by-case basis to determine whether it would be possible in some circumstances to divide it up. What I'm saying here, at least here, if we look at the product being sold, it's not easily divisible. Their own expert has said that. Their own expert says that there are pieces of this apparatus being sold that are used for both reading and writing.
What is the
going back to my original question? Substantial could be 50%, could be 25%, sometimes substantial could be less than 25%.
I suppose
how would it be determined?
I suppose it would depend on the particular case before you and whether you thought that was a trivial use or not, or non-substantial use.
Well,
what I'm suggesting here is...
What is substantial?
What I'm suggesting here is reading is clearly a substantial non-infringing use. A disk is useless if you can't read with it. So reading, that's not a question presented to you here in this case. Reading is clearly a substantial amount of infringing use. If you cannot read with that drive, it's useless. You don't want a drive that you can just record with. You need a drive that you can read with. So here, there's substantiality is not a question. So let's look at the facts of this case. Substantiality is clearly not a question. You can't divide the product as they suggest. Their own experts suggest you can't divide the product.
Substantiality is a question. Of course it's a question. The question is it a substantial non-infringing use if one part of the device can perform non-infringing functions, where the only use of another part of the device is to infringe.
But I don't think they've established that there's just software that by itself will infringe. That's not the limitations of the claim. The limitations of the claim require that you use a laser, and the laser is used for both reading and writing. So let's look at the entirety of what is being claimed here and determine whether that has a substantial non-infringing use. The entirety of what is being claimed here is also you need the laser in order to perform some of the steps of the method. You need to spin the disk in order to perform some of the steps of the method. And so if you look at the thing being sold, you can't divide it along the lines they're suggesting. It's not as easy as your hammer argument, Your Honor. It's not as divisible.
The thing that was sold in this case was a dual deck unit. One deck reads and one deck writes. And they are completely separate and separately electrically connected, but they're in the same housing, and that's what's being sold. Is that a contributory infringement?
I would like to know more facts, but I think you're getting perhaps closer to a situation where perhaps someone just tacked on a drive that could read to a box that was primarily designed to record. In that case, if that were the fact presented, then you know, in that situation, perhaps.
So it's not a question of just looking at the device that's sold, because in my hypothetical, the device that's sold is a dual deck unit.
But at least for this case, I would like to focus on the device being sold and the patent claims. And what is it they're claiming? They're claiming methods. For those methods, you need a laser. For those methods, you need to spin that disk. That motor that spins that disk, that laser is used for both reading and writing. So if you look at the thing being sold and the thing being claimed, there is a substantial amount of infringing use here, and that's reading. And it's not as easily divisible as they suggest. Their own expert has said that.
So if it's fact-dependent on this case, then maybe we have to have a trial to determine whether this case falls on one side of the line or the other side of the line, because apparently there's not very clear evidence right now as to what aspects of the hardware or software are devoted only to infringing uses.
Well, I think it is undisputed, Your Honor. I mean, if you look at Rico's own expert, he stated that each drive has a single laser used for both reading and writing. That's at A2072. It is quite clear that you cannot divide that laser between a reading and writing function.
That's only one feature. What about the other features?
Well, I think that should be enough. I mean, you're looking at the thing being sold. My suggestion is not to rewrite.
But coming back again to saying that the fact that some aspect of the invention can be used in a non-infringing manner is sufficient to make the whole thing non-infringing. That seems to be an extreme position. And you keep having difficulty telling us where to draw the line.
I think you draw the line by looking at what's being sold and what is being claimed. And if what is being claimed is and what is being sold here has a substantial non-infringing use, as in this case, on the undisputed facts, there is a substantial non-infringing use. I think the statute itself focuses on the component being sold, the thing being sold. I don't think the answer is to rewrite the statute. I think that would be the wrong way to approach the problem. If you're bothered by your hammer hypothetical, the thing to do is to look at inducement and whether there has been inducement and other indirect liability theories of infringement. It's not to rewrite the statute. I think the statute is quite clear that if the apparatus, the thing, the component being sold has a substantial non-infringing use, and there's no dispute that reading is a substantial non-infringing use, there is no liability for contributory infringement. That does not answer the question on inducement. I think that's the right way to look at this. I don't think it's possible to draw the line as you're suggesting. And in any event, in this case, it's clear that you cannot divide that apparatus as the plaintiff would suggest. Even their own expert disagrees with that.
But isn't there really a question of fact that has to be determined on the issue of inducement?
Well, I think the court was correct.
Going to a summary judgment basis on the issue of inducement?
I think that the court was correct in noting that the only evidence relevant to the inducement question was all directed to the branded computer companies. Quanta Storage manufactures the drives for licensed, not always licensed, but for optical disk drive manufacturers such as Philips and Sony. Philips and Sony then sell those optical disk drives to branded computer companies. The branded computer companies then put them in computers and sell them to end users. There's no evidence of any communication between the between Quanta Storage and end users. So any evidence at all of inducement would be directed to the branded computer companies. And those branded computer companies test a few sample drives every year. So I think it's important to point that out. Now, on the inducement question, they point to technical specifications. Well, first of all, they point to a technical presentation made by jointly by Quanta Storage and Philips to Dell. In the first instance, I don't think that's relevant evidence because Philips, there's no dispute, its drives are licensed. And the witness, Mr. Chen, testified that you need to look at, on a case-by-case basis, to determine what was in each presentation to each branded computer company. So I don't think you can extrapolate from that one presentation and say they're all the same, as the plaintiff is trying to do here.
Does Quanta also sell end products that include these drives?
Quanta Computer sells computers to branded computer companies, but Quanta Storage does not. Quanta Storage sells some drives to move.
Quanta Computer sells the entire computer.
Yes, Your Honor.
To the branded company. And with respect to those items, is there any communication between Quanta and the ultimate consumer of the product?
There's no evidence of any communication between Quanta Computer and the ultimate consumer of the product. In fact, the only communications that we have here are emails, and I think plaintiff's counsel misspoke. Those emails are not directed to Quanta Storage. They're directed to Hewlett-Packard. Who then passes them to Quanta Storage, and Quanta Storage simply replaces the drive. And it would have been possible to do marketing studies to find out how many users recorded and did other things while they were recording, which might have given rise to a buffer underrun, or recorded using what media at what speeds. All of those things could have been done, but were not done. And you could just pull the Dell's customers in general and get that information, even if you didn't know that a particular computer had what particular drive in it, at least you would have an idea how end users use these drives. And in fact, if you used the sales data that was produced by Dell, you could have figured out what computers were sold with what particular drive and done that kind of study. That wasn't done here.
Would Dell be a contributory infringer if it sold a computer that had a disk drive that only performed the right capabilities that we're discussing here? Because arguably, the computer has a substantial non-infringing use for other purposes.
Would
Dell not a contributory infringer because, after all, the computer can do a host of other things totally unrelated?
I think that comes back to the same question we were debating before on contributory infringement. Is what Dell selling, does it have a substantial non-infringing use? And if so...
Yeah, and my hypothetical is that the write drive that is connected only performs the functions set forth in the method claims.
So there's no non-infringement.
The question about is it a read or a write, it's only a write-capable drive that performs these specific functions set forth in these method claims.
If it's only capable of performing the specific functions set forth in the method claims, I think it could be a contributory infringement.
But yet they're selling, the product that they're selling is a computer with the write drive as a component.
Oh,
the computer has a substantial non-infringing use. You can use it for a host of things having nothing to do with the drive.
That's true.
I the hook for contributory infringement.
I understood you to suggest that they were selling only a drive.
No, a computer with the drive that only performs the write capability specified in these method claims. Are they off the hook? They're not a contributory infringer.
I think under the statute, you would look at what was being sold. And if it has a substantial non-infringing use, then they wouldn't be a contributory infringer, but they certainly may be guilty of inducement. I think that's the proper analysis.
But you still be required to show some communication to the direct infringer.
Yes, there would have to be some communication with the direct infringer. There would have to be some encouragement of those end users to record with the drives. That's all you would need Judge Lynn's hypothetical, because the recording automatically performed those features, but of course that's not our case.
So you're saying they're not necessarily off the hook, they may be subject to an inducement claim.
That's correct. They still may be subject to an inducement claim. There are apparatus claims in these patents as well, and they could have sued on those apparatus claims, and Dell could be, in your hypothetical, could be sued on the apparatus claims, and then you don't need to look at this issue. They chose not to sue on the apparatus claims. They could have done that. That's another way to look at the particular issue. That's a choice they made. But the statute is clear. If the thing being sold has a substantial non-infringing use, you're not liable for contributory infringement. Although, admittedly, that does not answer the inducement question. That is a separate issue that you should take up. Quickly, the website.
Mr. Byrne mentioned that 4 seconds.
4 seconds. Okay. I think I'll concede my 4 seconds. Thank you, Your Honor.
I'll try to cover just a couple of points briefly in response. On the inducement issue. There is, in addition to the advertising that we spoke of earlier, there is also evidence of repair, service, and replacement of the drives for end users carried out by Quanta, including software updates specifically for example, the write strategy, which are directed to the infringing features of the drives. And that does indicate an intent on the part of Quanta to perpetuate the infringing use on the part of end users. On the question of whether design can suffice to show inducement where there is evidence of intent to cause infringement, I would direct the court's attention to page 22 of our brief, the Water Technologies case, the Crystal Semiconductor case, and the other cases cited there. I think strongly stand for the proposition that design can give rise to an infringement, an inducement liability. And finally, the additional piece of inducement evidence is, again, when the drives don't perform as promised and the end users complain about it, that is evidence that the drives are being used in the intended fashion. With regard to contributory infringement, respectfully, I think Mr. Garnett was taking the question by saying, well, you look at the thing sold, you look at the thing sold. The question that the court kept asking was, where do you draw the line? How do you decide what to look at, and we would answer that by saying that one looks to the specific language of the statute, and any time one sells a separable component constituting a material part of the invention, one has crossed into 271C liability, and that may happen.
What material part of the invention being if you're talking about a method?
I think a material part of the invention in this context would mean something that is used to meet at least one claim limitation. I think that would be a sensible starting point for that. And here we do have software that's used to meet a number of the claim limitations in terms of the way it controls the drives. And ultimately, to the extent that that one were to accept Mr. Garnett's invitation to decide all of this on a case-by-case basis, then this would surely be a case that would need to be sent back for a jury to decide whether there were substantial non-infringing uses of the various components at issue.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Case is submitted.